Blog Talk Radio.
Today we talk about Sweden, the favorite country of the left. Bernie Sanders went on a whole tirade on TV last weekend telling us how wonderful the Swedish state was and how he would lead America towards that fantastic reality. So what a make of Sweden. That's what we're going to talk about today. By the way, I will be in Sweden in November, so is there a sound? Can anybody hear me? Can anybody hear me out there? All right, some of you do, some of you can't hear. All right, so sound is on. So the Swedish state, how good is it? What's really going on in Sweden? How do we compare it to the United States? We've brought on an expert, Carl Svenberg, not just expert because he was born in Sweden, but because he's researched this and he's spoken about it and he's done a fair bit of research here. So, Carl, are you there?
I am here. Can you hear me?
I can. Volume is a little low, so you might want to just yell a little bit, but I can hear you. So, go ahead. Yeah, it's still low, so I'm not sure why. Maybe it's just me. Let me ask the people in the chat, can you hear Carl? Carl, say something. Say hello to our listeners.
Hello, everybody.
Can you guys hear him? All right. So I'm just going to go over, I made a list of all the wonderful things Bernie Sanders said about Sweden. And I'm sure there are many, many more. And we'll talk about all of those, and then we'll try to dismantle them and figure out what the truth is about the Swedish state. I'll just note that Bernie is not the only one to view Sweden as some kind of ideal. In almost every Q&A every talk that I participate in the Q&A, the question is, but what about Sweden? Doesn't Sweden refute all of you capitalists and everything you guys say about capitalism? So this is a common fallacy that exists out there, the huge, wonderful, utopian land of Sweden. But let's start with Bernie's. So Bernie, what did Bernie say was great about Sweden? Voter turnout. That was the first thing he said. They have a robust, wonderful, healthy democracy. Voter turnout. Lots of people go to vote in America. Relatively speaking, relative to Sweden, very few people vote, and this is very, very important, of course. Healthcare is a right in Sweden. College education and grad school is free. Retirement benefits are really strong, particularly as compared to the United States. Childcare is strong and, I believe, funded by the government. Government works for middle class rather than the billionaire class, so the government takes more for the billionaires and gives more to the middle class. There's less inequality, which is reflective of that. Stronger middle class, again, reflective of that. Higher minimum wages in Sweden, which is supposedly really, really good. We'll get to that as we go through the discussion. And Sweden is just cleaner. They have a cleaner environment. Their water's cleaner. Their air is cleaner. Their streets are cleaner. The people there are cleaner, I think. Everything is cleaner in Sweden. All right. So what do we make of all this? What do we make of this obsession of the left with Sweden? And remember, Bernie is talking here about this as an attempt to defend his socialism. So his argument is, I'm a social democrat, and social democracy works. And here's an example of social democracy at work here in Sweden. So, Carl, what's the first thing that comes into your mind when you hear this list of wonders that is Sweden?
The first thing that comes up in my mind?
Well, it's not the first thing already, because you're already thinking about it, so just respond.
I mean, let's just start with the big picture that a lot of people, I mean, the reason people, especially the left, love Sweden is because it seems to prove that you can have socialism, or at least social democracy, and you can have the prosperity of capitalism, so to speak, and you can have social justice at the same time, or freedom and equality, for another way. And it's true that, on the whole, Sweden has, you know, historically a very high standard of living, and still have. And life is in many ways nice in Sweden. But this has nothing to do with social democracy or socialism. Sweden it became rich and prosperous in the 19th century because it was almost laissez-faire capitalistic. And then in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, when Bernie Sanders, the spiritual, you know, brothers in arms, the Social Democrats of Sweden, when they tried to turn Sweden into a social democratic country, then Sweden started to, you know, lag behind. It became actually relatively poorer compared to the rest of the world.
So let's before you go on, Carl, let's talk a little bit about the capitalist period in Sweden, because I think this is important and people don't really know this. But my understanding is between 1870 and really World War II, Sweden was one of the freest countries in the world, maybe from economic perspective, the freest country in Europe, and had some of the highest growth rates, economic growth rates, anywhere in the world. Is that right?
Yeah, that is right. Just for as an example, between the period you mentioned, 1870, and until at least sometime in 1930, Sweden definitely had the highest economic growth in the world, bar none. And even as late as until the 1970s, the only country that came close, or maybe even beat Sweden a little bit, was Japan. But, I mean, they were rebuilding themselves after the Second World War, so that doesn't really count. It's definitely true.
And to what extent was during this period Sweden free, economically free? That is, to what extent was it capitalist during this period?
Well, I mean, they just were not that many regulations. So there were definitely no minimum wage. Taxes were very low for most people, including, of course, businessmen. We had unions, but they didn't have any particular legal privileges. The government was very small. As late as in the end of the 19th century until 1920s, the size of the government was just a fraction of what it is today, between 5% and 10% of GDP, for example. So we had a very small government, and we had the almost free trade.
What about a safety net and redistribution of wealth? Was there a significant safety net in those days?
There was almost none of that at all. There were small fragments, but most of it was like in America. It was voluntary associations, unions who organized stuff like that. People saved for their own retirement. But there were virtually no government redistribution of any kind back in those days.
And I read somewhere that almost all the companies that have been successful in Sweden, that are still successful companies in Sweden, were actually founded in that period. That is, if you look at the post-70s, you know, there's been very few successful companies founded in Sweden. Almost all of them were founded in the pre-socialist era. And some of the most successful and largest companies in Europe were actually in Sweden during this period of time.
Yeah, and actually, if one looks at the details of those numbers, most of them were actually started in the 19th century when the economy was the freest. So there's a strong correlation in Sweden's history in this respect, freedom and entrepreneurship.
And a lot of wealth was created during this period, a lot of very wealthy families.
Oh, yeah. I mean, take one example. Do you know about the Tetra Pak?
Nope, nothing.
Okay. Well, it's a good example. The Tetra Pak was a company founded in the, let's see if I remember, 50s or 60s, something like that. And they are known for creating a technology where you can package food, you know, in like milk cartridges and stuff like that. But they can do it in a very hygienic way. And a lot of people don't know about this, but they are like the major innovator in this field. And this invention to package food in this way has been regarded as one of the greatest inventions when it comes to food packaging. And the family is very rich and very successful. So you would think that a lot of people know about this family, but unfortunately, they were not treated that well in Sweden because, you know, of the egalitarian culture of Sweden. So they have to leave. And actually, I can tell you more about that later. But anyway, I'm sorry, I was rambling a little bit.
No, that's fine. So a lot of successful people actually left. But let's talk about kind of how did Sweden become socialist? So we had this incredible period from the 1870s through the 1930s, and then that somewhat continued into the 1960s. But what was the turning point in terms of making Sweden kind of a model of socialism? When did that happen, and what was the dynamics of how that happened?
It began in the 60s, especially the end of the 60s. In Europe, including Sweden around that time, there was a great, what is called, turn to the left. And
yep.
This in part had to do with, unfortunately, the Vietnam War. A lot of people, you know, they said, look, America equals capitalism. America is killing innocent people in Vietnam. This proves capitalism in America is evil and wrong, and if you want a socially just, fair society based on decency and dignity, we have to turn towards socialism. And so there was a major turn to the left in Europe around that time. And also, especially in Sweden, in 1959, we got the Social Democratic Party elected a new leader. His name was Olof Palme, and he was quite radical, unlike his predecessor. For a very long time, the Social Democratic Party was very pragmatic because they knew that, you know, you can't slaughter the goose that is laying all the golden eggs, you know. But now the time was right. Sweden was very rich and prosperous around this time, and a lot of people felt like now it's time to reap the benefits. Now we should really, you know, build the welfare state that we have all been talking about for such a long time. And Olof Palme promised to deliver, and that he did. So in the 70s, the welfare state that people associate Sweden with was created, but
tell us a little bit about that socialist state. What did that mean? Did they nationalize the means of production? Did they engage in massive What kind of tax rates are we talking about? What kind of redistribution of wealth? Give us a little flavor of what socialism looked like under, you know, in the 1970s and 80s in Sweden.
Okay. well, no, they did not really nationalize a lot of things. It happened a little bit later, but that was, I look as far as the redistribution and all that. Like in the 60s, to have a comparison, taxes in Sweden were about as high as they are in America around that time and still today, okay? So say the average income tax was 15% for a normal person in the 60s, early 60s. But by already 1980, it wasn't uncommon for a typical Sven, you know, to pay at least 30% income tax, okay? So, and then I have included all the taxes. If you include all the taxes, it was not uncommon for the average guy to pay at least 50% of his income, income in taxes in the early 80s. And if you were, you know, stupid enough to go into business, you could face marginal tax rate sometimes approaching 90%.
And during this period, did business regulation increase?
Yes. For example, labor markets especially were severely regulated in the 70s. I haven't memorized it, but there's a long list of the regulations that came about in the 70s. And this was all a way for the Social Democrats to give the unions everything they have not managed to negotiate themselves to, you know, through voluntary means. But it's now, what is it called? They especially introduced a regulation that made it very difficult to fire people. I don't know the English name for this law, but like some sort of work security law. This has been a headache for businessmen ever since, at least for small entrepreneurs.
So this is kind of what was brought about in the 1970s and 1980s. What was the consequence to the Swedish economy that had been doing so fantastically well up until that point?
Well, it definitely slowed down dramatically in the 70s and the 80s. It used to grow in the 50s and 60s by comparison by about 3 to almost 5% per year. But in the 70s and the 80s, it slowed down to about 2% per year. So it was quite a dramatic change. And just by comparison, virtually, well, not maybe every, but definitely the vast majority of all the other Western European countries grew faster than Sweden did during this time. And that was definitely not a coincidence. So I always laugh when people say that high taxes don't have an impact, for instance, because America, for example, during the exact same time was growing way faster. And I find it ridiculous for people to claim these things. But I can also give you another startling indication of the destructive impact of all these regulations and taxes. So this is a fact that not a lot of people know. Between 1950 and 1990, and I think even as late as the year 2000, did you know that there was net not a single new job in the private sector?
Sweden. No, I didn't know that.
And during the same time, of course, the population was growing by about 2 million people. Now, where do they end up? Well, a lot of them did get a job from the government, of course, because the government was expanding. But a lot of them, of course, ended up living on welfare, becoming unemployed. So if we count in all these people, all the people who basically have nowhere else to turn than to the welfare state for their support and survival. By some estimates, one made by the largest union in Sweden, about 20% are dependent on welfare for their survival. 20% of the labor force, that is.
So that's unbelievable.
But that is just one tiny little effect of what happens when you, for decades, oppress and plunder businessmen and entrepreneurs with taxes and regulations. They will become way less inclined to invest, way less inclined to start businesses, and of course, then there are fewer opportunities and jobs around. So, and I can go on, but
sure. We're going to take a quick break. When we get back, Carl is going to stay with us through the break. When we get back, we'll talk about kind of what happened in Sweden in the early 90s and where we are today with regard to Sweden from a purely economic perspective. But then we're going to talk about Swedish society and the other costs of socialism, which nobody ever talks about. We'll be right back. You're listening. The Yvonne Brooks Show.
With adoring fans, rabid critics, and very few in between, why does Atlas Shrugged evoke such impassioned responses? Because it grapples with the fundamental problems of human existence and it presents radically new answers. Atlas Shrugged challenges many conventional notions about good and evil, that sex is a low animal desire, that money is the root of evil, that man is sinful by nature. One of the most prominent is the notion that selfishness is evil and self-sacrifice is good. Atlas Shrugged is a dramatization of Ayn Rand's unique vision of existence and of man's highest potential. 12 years in the writing, it is her masterwork. Rand's worldview emerges in the plot turns of this compelling mystery, centered on one question: who is John Galt? There are many legends. Which of these is true? Is he the man who discovered the Fountain of Youth? The man who found the lost city of Atlantis? A modern Prometheus? Does he even exist? And why, if no one knows the answer, does the entire world know his name? Find out the answer when you read the novel that sparked a philosophical revolution. Order it today on Amazon.com.
The Ayn Rand Institute campus is an exciting online destination offering free e-courses on Ayn Rand and her revolutionary philosophy of objectivism. Whether you recently picked up your first Rand book or have been reading her novels and nonfiction for years, ARI Campus has something for you. On campus, you'll discover a variety of multimedia courses covering Rand's literary classics, specific aspects of thought, and how to apply her ideas to your life. Get started today at campus.aynrand.org. See you on campus.
In 1934, Ayn Rand wrote to journalist and essayist H.L. Mencken, "Perhaps it may seem a lost cause at present, and there are those who will say that I am too late, that I can only hope to be the last fighter for a mode of thinking which has no place in the future. But I do not think so. I intend to be the first one in a new battle, which the world needs as it has never needed before, the first to answer the many too many advocates of collectivism and answer them in a manner which will not be forgotten. Every day at ARI, we work to make sure that Ayn Rand's answer will not be forgotten. Help us. Contribute today at AynRand.org/support.
The Ayn Rand Institute's mission is to promote Ayn Rand's philosophy of reason, rational self-interest, and laissez-faire capitalism. We are currently looking for talented, passionate, and bright people who share our goal of advancing Ayn Rand's ideas in the world. The Ayn Rand Institute offers you the opportunity to impact the culture and make a difference each and every day. If you're interested in working at the Ayn Rand Institute, visit us at AynRand.org today. There you'll find details on employment opportunities and how to apply.
Every day we hear from political leaders that the American dream is vanishing because of rising income inequality. The rich are getting richer by rigging the system, leaving the rest of us to struggle to get by. To save the American dream, we're told that we need to fight inequality through tax hikes, wealth redistribution schemes, and a far higher minimum wage. But what if that narrative is wrong? What if the real threat to the American dream is not rising inequality, but forced equality? In their forthcoming book, Equal is Unfair, America's Misguided Fight Against Income Inequality, Don Watkins and Yaron Brook reveal that almost everything we've been taught about inequality is wrong. You'll discover why successful CEOs make so much money and why they should, how the minimum wage hurts the very people it claims to help, why claims of middle class stagnation are a myth, and more. For more information or to pre-order the book, Equal is Unfair, visit your favorite bookseller or go to Amazon.com.
All right, we're back. You're listening to the Iran Book Show. We've got Carl Svenberg, who's a writer at the Ayn Rand Institute and a colleague of mine at the Institute. And we're talking about Sweden. We're talking about the myth of Sweden as some kind of socialist utopia and its success. So far, what we've really said is Sweden's real success, Sweden's real prosperity is a product of capitalism. It's a product of capitalism in the late 19th century and early 20th century. And indeed, when Sweden turned to socialism in the late 1960s, economic growth plummeted. The number of people on welfare, you know, skyrocketed. The number of people dependent on the government skyrocketed. Jobs were not created. And leading up to 1994, is my understanding, Sweden was taking on enormous amounts of debt in order to fund all this. That is, in spite of those high taxes, or actually because of those high taxes, the Sweden state didn't have enough money to pay and to redistribute and to do everything that it had done. Business was going out of business. People were leaving Sweden. Wasn't it Jan Borg who also left Sweden because of taxes? And wasn't ABBA, I think at ABBA in the 1980s, wasn't ABBA the largest industry in Sweden by revenue? You know, that's a pop group was beating out all industries. I mean, that's how pathetic Swedish, or how successful ABBA was, but how pathetic Swedish industry became. So by 1994, my understanding is that Sweden was basically bankrupt, that nobody would lend it money, that it was the equivalent, not quite, but similar to what Greece has become. Is that true, and what happened post-1994?
It's true enough for our purpose. the problem is that what exactly led Sweden into that position in the early 90s is a little bit complicated. But in essence, yes, the combination of all the typical institutions of the welfare state, the regulations, and the high taxes especially, and let me add a thing you didn't mention, basically crazy unions that had been empowered in the 70s by all these regulations to now every now and then make outrageous demands. All these things combined in the late 1980s pushed Sweden over the limit, so to speak, and brought the country into a lot of problems in the early 90s. And there was some other things too, but the welfare state played a major role in causing a lot of trouble for Sweden. And I think actually it's not that unfair to compare it to Greece, but fortunately it didn't end up that way, as you said. And in my view, one reason that didn't happen was because in the 90s and especially the 2000s, Sweden took a lot of steps away from the old model, because a lot of people realized that this just can't continue. So government welfare handouts and benefits, they have been cut, especially for unemployed people and sick people. And they have also cut taxes quite dramatically. Just as, to give you one example for working people, the typical working person in Sweden in 2014, he now keeps an entire month's salary after taxes, compared to 2006, okay? So that's an example of massive tax cuts. Another one, which a lot of people don't know, and I think Bernie Sanders and all the other people on the left would be quite shocked and upset if they found out, is that in Sweden, they did not just get rid of a wealth tax. You know, we had a tax on the most productive and the richest ones. You know, it was just to steal their money and to punish them for being successful, because it didn't generate virtually any revenues at all, you know, because they just took their money and left. So it was just a symbolic tax altogether. But they removed that one. And another thing not a lot of people don't know about, Sweden got rid of the inheritance tax. Okay.
There's no inheritance tax in Sweden today?
Correct.
Wow.
And that was maybe 10 years ago. So that's, I mean, when I tell people that, I can't believe it, but it's true. And just to give a couple more examples of how things have changed, the corporate tax rate, as late as 1989, it was 50%, I think. Today, it's down to 22%.
Lower than the United States.
I mean, take that, Bernie Sanders. Way
lower.
It's lower
than the U.S.
Yes.
In the U.S., it's 35%, so it's significantly lower than the U.S. corporate tax rate.
Yeah, and I should, of course, mention, just for clarity, that even this was the statutory rate. Fortunately, even in 1989, a lot of especially big businesses did not pay that high rate, because this is it has to be said that if businesses in Sweden, especially big businesses, had to pay the high taxes that the wage earners in Sweden are paying, then in like deep trouble, because and I know I'm just going on because I'm so excited about this, and I will let you interrupt me in a little bit. But
now you're making Sweden sound like some kind of a capitalist utopia, maybe not a socialist utopia, but that isn't true either, right?
No, it isn't true. Sweden is a mixed bag and a mixed economy, so it's a lot of different things, and it's just gotten better and worse in different periods, and I have so much to tell you, but let's just take one thing at a time, and then I will let you ask the next question. Because I always react when Bernie Sanders and people like him say that in Sweden we have a government sort of middle class, but that is it's so much BS. I'm sorry, but it's total nonsense. The reason Sweden has survived is because you can make this case that in some ways they are soaking the middle class, but not necessarily the businesses themselves, so to speak. So that's why we can have any industry at all, despite all this, but they just rob the people instead. But I will stop there.
There's a lot less business regulation. There's a lot less controls on business. And I've seen Sweden ranks about at the same place as the United States in terms of economic freedom, in spite of redistributing a lot more wealth than the United States does.
Yeah, and I just want to... in my mind, I'm jumping back and forth in the decades, you see, so that's why also this is a little bit confusing. All in all, when it comes to controls and taxes for businesses, they are much better today than they were 20 years ago. I only meant to say, that even 20, 30 years ago, the tax system systematically punished working people, but sometimes they let businesses, especially big businesses, off the hook a little bit, but they did that only to keep them around at all, so to speak, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So today Sweden is a lot better than it was 20, 30 years ago. It's moved much more in the direction of economic freedom. But it still is a mixed economy. It still is a mixed economy, which might treat business well in a sense of less regulation, much lower taxes than in the United States, but still engages in massive redistribution of wealth. So there's still and the state is still significantly bigger than the American state in terms of government spending, although again a lot fewer agencies, a lot less regulation, a lot less control. But so how does this manifest today in life in Sweden? Because you obviously left Sweden to come to the America. Because you believe things here are better in spite of the fact that in some ways economic freedom is greater in Sweden than it is in America.
Yeah, well, I'm not a normal person. I'm not maybe the best person to ask why I left Sweden also. Just let me clarify that. For me, culture matters a lot, too. It's not just whether finally Sweden has become a little bit better And so maybe I should stay, you know. That didn't go in entirely my equation. It's also a matter of the culture. Like, do I feel at home in this type of society?
Well, let's talk about the culture. So what is it about Swedish culture as compared to American culture that makes you feel more at home here than in Sweden?
Well, Sweden is extremely egalitarian, much more so than the U.S. We have, as you have mentioned on this show earlier, Sweden is known not just for envy, but for this thing called Jantelagen, the jaw of Jante.
Yep.
And it's basically a name for a mega egalitarian mentality in the culture that if, you know, you're not ever supposed to believe that you are someone, or that you have achieved anything, or that you should be proud of anything, or brag about anything. That is so much resented. And of course, it is reflected both in the laws, like especially back in the day when they were systematically punishing people for being successful. But, you know, take ABBA, take, you know, the Roxette, the band, or Europe, another band. There are a lot of bands, especially artists, who make it big in the world, and a lot of people resent them and look down upon them because they have been so successful internationally. And, I mean, or what about this? Like, they, every year, newspapers make long lists telling the whole world, like, how much people are making. And they're especially making a big deal of these people are making the most in your neighborhood. And then
so they're trying to shame. Trying to shame people for being successful. So this is something that I've wondered about. Given the law of Jante, how did Sweden become capitalist in 1870? That is, how did capitalism survive for so long, or relative capitalism survive for so long in Sweden, given this culture of egalitarianism?
It is,
that?
As I said earlier, I mean, in my view, this is just a reflection of pure pragmatism. Like, I mean, not in the philosophic sense, but like in the sense that the social democrats, they knew that it would be, you know, a disaster if they actually tried to socialize the economy and you know, tax businessmen and productive people to death. That is the main reason this egalitarianism didn't immediately translate into policy. And Swedes, as a the Swedish culture on the whole, is still quite. You can call it pragmatic if you want. Swedes resent extremism of any type. We pride ourselves of being the land of lagom. You can't even translate it, but it means something like we are proud middle of the roaders. So no one could in the 40s or 50s say, Let's go after the capitalists and tax them to death, because that wouldn't fly. People react to that only on the grounds that it sounds too radical.
So that is a major reason
why I think capitalism is right.
But in a sense, the 60s and 70s, the socialism, is much more consistent with this egalitarianism that's embedded in the Swedish culture than was the capitalism previously, or even the relative, you know, slightly relative economic freedom they have today. And it's why, you know, you'd think Sweden would keep gravitating more towards socialism over time.
I mean, yeah, and the thing is, when it comes to fundamentals, nothing has really priced if, in the near future, Sweden will once again turn to the left, you know. As you have also discussed in other shows, or at least in your other talks, sometimes things go overboard, and then the people temporarily react, and they think, okay, I guess we have to get rid of some controls now, and I mean, they did it even this in the Soviet Union. So why
yep.
couldn't they do it in Sweden? So so I think that is definitely part of the equation. So I am not egalitarianism and all these things that I don't like with the Swedish culture. They haven't, you know, really changed that fundamentally. It goes in waves. And I therefore wouldn't be surprised if things would once again, years from now, go downhill. And as a matter of fact, we had a right-wing government for 8 years, which is quite amazing. Actually, this data point strongly suggests what we're talking about. Listen to this. Not a lot of people know this, but the Social Democratic Party in Sweden ruled the country between 1932 to 1976. And then they got back to power in 1982 and ruled until 91, and then from 94 to 2006. And now they're back again. So think about that. That is, what, 65 out of 74 years they were in power.
Yeah.
So if that track record tells us anything, is that, yeah, Sweden will definitely most likely go back at some point to a more socialistic order.
Okay. We're going to hold off right now. When I come back, I want to make the comparison with Canada because I think there's a lot of parallels here. And then we're gonna talk a little bit more about what's going on in Sweden right now and some of the ugly side of Swedish culture. We've already talked about some of that, but more of that about the ugly side of Swedish society right now, which the left conveniently ignores. We'll be right back. You're listening to Ron Brooks Show.
Selfishness, a virtue? It is according to the moral principles of objectivism. Conventional morality tells you to sacrifice your values to satisfy the needs of others. Ayn Rand opposes that view and offers a new concept of egoism, an ethics of rational selfishness that rejects sacrifice in all its forms. In The Virtue of Selfishness, Ayn Rand defies conventional thought, setting out a philosophy that holds man as a heroic being, with his own happiness as the moral purpose of his life. Explore Rand's new concept of egoism and order The Virtue of Selfishness at Amazon.com today.
You didn't build that. You don't pay your fair share. Who do you think you are? Ayn Rand knew exactly who you are. Rational, productive, independent. You work hard and use your own judgment. You choose your career path, your lifestyle, your values. You're living the American dream. And now you see that there are people who want to take away what you've created and who will call their lust to loot a virtue. People who think the needs of others is a claim on your money, your work, your life. Well, how can you fight back? That's what they do at the Ayn Rand Institute. They look closely at public policy beyond sound bites and election cycles, at the fundamental moral ideas that frame crucial debates. They focus on reframing the issues in line with reason, egoism, and individual rights to life, liberty, property, and the pursuit of happiness. Your life, liberty, property, and the pursuit of your happiness. Stand up with them to fight against the sacrifice of your values by making a contribution today at AynRand.org/support. They'll use your money to defend your values.
The Ayn Rand Institute's mission is to promote Ayn Rand's philosophy of reason, rational self-interest, and laissez-faire capitalism. We are currently looking for talented, passionate, and bright people who share our goal of advancing Ayn Rand's ideas in the world. The Ayn Rand Institute offers you the opportunity to impact the culture and make a difference each and every day. If you're interested in working at the Ayn Rand Institute, visit us at AynRand.org today. There you'll find details on employment opportunities and how to apply.
Ayn Rand was a radical thinker whose philosophical novels challenged students to reconsider their views on fundamental issues. The Fountainhead, Atlas Shrugged, and Anthem. These works have become classics of American literature that never fail to engage young people and stimulate intense classroom discussion. By offering these works for free to teachers, the Ayn Rand Institute hopes to encourage greater awareness and understanding of Rand's stimulating perspective. If you're a teacher who would like Ayn Rand's books in your classroom, visit AynRand.org. This is at no cost to you. Go to AynRand.org today.
For 30 years, the Ayn Rand Institute has been on the front lines of the culture wars, introducing millions of students to Ayn Rand's books and ideas, educating young intellectuals who now teach at universities around the world, and speaking out in defense of free speech, free markets, and free minds. You can join our battle for reason, individualism, and capitalism by making your contribution today at AynRand.org/support.
All right, so we're back. We're talking to Carl Svenberg, who's a writer at the Ayn Rand Institute and who is a Swede and has done a lot of research on the issue of Sweden. So I want to shift a little bit, Carl, because there's a lot of really negative news coming out of Sweden, which you would think people would be concerned about, but maybe not people like Bernie Sanders, but that certainly we should be considered it. We should be concerned about, and here we're for primarily to their attacks on free speech and the fact that in Sweden today you have real hate speech laws and that it's you can go to jail for expressing yourself. I know of a couple of recent examples of this, but any thoughts about the whole issue of free speech in Sweden these days?
I mean, yeah, you're right that we have these laws and it's really bad. But I would the problem I have with free, how should I put it? Like, the problem is actually it's very complicated because.
How can free speech be complicated, right? I mean, you either have it or you don't.
Speech, not free speech as such, but like what is going on in Sweden with speech and the debate about it is a big mess in Sweden. That's what I mean.
Okay. And then I think the free speech issue is relevant and becoming very visible in Sweden these days, because of the huge influx of Muslim migrants and the whole issue of or the whole idea of anybody criticizing this immigration, anybody advocating for limits on this immigration, there's a clear attempt to silence those people.
Yes. It's that's part of the complications I meant, because some of the silencing, I mean, what I'm trying to say is it's more cultural than maybe even legal, because people are silenced long before there are any discussions about whether someone is breaking the law, because the intellectual establishment in Sweden is so much in favor of multiculturalism. So
sure.
Anyone who ever criticizes any aspect of immigration or the type of immigrants that are coming, a lot of them are frozen out of their jobs, they're fired, they are denounced on Facebook of all the friends. So it's a lot of cultural repression. And that is what I meant when I said it's a little bit complicated and not just a matter of that we don't have free speech legally.
Sure. So let's talk a little bit about the extent to which this multiculturalism is causing kind of a bifurcation within a Swedish society, where Muslims are not expected to integrate into society, but are living in a sense completely separate lives, separate neighborhoods, separate places. To what extent is that a real problem in Sweden today?
I think that is like definitely a real problem. And I know this guy who's a great economist, and his name is Tino Sanandaji. He's a Kurd from Iraq, I think. He has written tons on this matter. But just based on his reports from Sweden, since I don't live there anymore, it's really bad, and it's causing all kinds of social conflicts. And I want to tell you a story, if you don't mind, which will paint you a picture of how all of this is like tearing the country apart socially and culturally. Not a lot of people know this, but in Sweden, we have rent controls, and they are really bad, okay? In Stockholm, Sweden, 500,000 people are in waiting lines, you know, to get an apartment. The average waiting time is 8 years, okay, to get a first-time contract in Sweden.
Wow.
Okay. Now, we're taking in all these refugees. And whatever we think about whether we should do that or not, the fact is that there's such a shortage of housing. And we have to shelter them somewhere, right? So what is the government doing? They are giving these refugees, or at least some of them, a pass. They can cut the line. And so they can get an apartment in weeks, while people have been waiting for years to get this apartment, okay? So you can imagine just a little thing like that creates a lot of tension and resentment between people. And that's just a little fraction. Or what about this? This didn't exist at least 20 years ago, 30 years ago. But Sweden now, people believe Swedes are very tolerant, but Swedes don't actually want a lot of these people to come in, whatever you think about that. So now we have white flight, as they call it here in America. It's really weird how Sweden is changing in this sense. And another thing is that a lot of the people who are coming in, whether they don't want to do it or they just can't work, you know, because they can't speak the language, and a lot of them don't have much of an education. And Sweden, because of taxes and regulations and unions, there is no low-wage labor market for most of these people.
Because of a high minimum wage, right?
A lot of these people, yeah, have a minimum wage, but we have a de facto one because unions, you know, they have all these contracts enforced. Anyway, so whether they want to work or they don't want to work, a lot of them, they just can't work. So a lot of people rightly think of these people as just a lot of cost coming in. And, you know, imagine this. I don't think a lot of people know this, but every day, 160,000 people are expected to come into Sweden this year. Now, Sweden is a country of 9 million people.
Yep.
So,
and these are almost all Muslims.
Yeah. So the point
Who are not going to assimilate, who are not going to integrate into society. I need to ask you this question before we don't have a lot of time. Let me ask you. I've read that Sweden has the highest rates of rape in the Western world. One, do you think that's true? Second, how much of that is these Muslim migrants? How much of it is the definition of rape in Sweden? What is the story with rape in Sweden? You know, again, something I read about a lot, but it's hard to get actual facts.
I have to disappoint you. I actually do not know the truth about that. I have not investigated it enough, and I don't want to accidentally spread something that might just be a rumor.
Good. No, I mean that's much better. So let's stick with that. It's something worth looking into because I don't know what's going on there. It could be. I mean, there's a number of different explanations for it, but it's making the rounds and it's worth getting some actual knowledge around it. Okay, let's try to summarize here. Sweden's not as socialist as people claim it is, and Sweden's not as good as people claim it is. I want you to say something about what all the redistribution, what the welfare state, the essential nature of the welfare state, which Sweden is, does to the population. What does it do to the spirit of people? What is it, you know, what does it do to kind of their behavior, their sense of life, and the quality of life of somebody who is an individualist who tries to live in Sweden?
That's a great question. I will answer the question like this. When I grew up, and I know a lot of at least pro-freedom Swedes can relate to this, there is like this view in Sweden that if it weren't for the welfare state and all this redistribution, most of us would be helpless, pathetic, you know, we will not be able to survive, we will not be able to make it, that we are like nothing if it weren't for the welfare state. A lot of people believe that we have a good life in Sweden because of the welfare state. And this view, like thinking of yourself as basically weak and pathetic and helpless, that view is reinforced by the very existence of the welfare state in Sweden. And it works like this. First, they tax you to death, okay? As I said earlier, the average guy in Sweden, even some low-income earners, pay more than half of their income in taxes. So think about that. You pay more in taxes than you pay for housing, clothes, rent, whatever. Everything else is less than your taxes. So a lot of people, they actually, you know, if it weren't for some handout, some subsidy, or the so-called free healthcare or whatever, you know, it would definitely seem like life is really hard. Like, how am I going to make it with this, you know, what I have left after all the taxes? And then the government comes in and it subsidizes your life and gives you all these checks or whatever. So it reinforces this view that you can't live without the state, without the wealth, like without the government taking care of you. And to me, this is one of the most unattractive parts, both spiritually and materially, of course. You know, you're less free. You can't use your money the way you think is best. And a lot of people are, through the nature of the system, brought up to believe that they will be nothing without the state. And that is, in my view, a very self-destructive impact of the
yeah, I mean, it destroys the soul. The soul of anybody worthwhile ultimately is destroyed in a place like that. And I think that's what socialism and the law of Junte and just this egalitarian notion does to human beings. Carl, thanks for joining us. This was great. We're going to be taking a break. And when I come back, I'm going to try to wrap up some of our discussion on Sweden. And I'm also going to be discussing, hopefully I have time, we're going to take a call. I see there's a caller, so we're going to take a call. And I'm also going to be discussing Silicon Valley. You know, kind of end on a up note today, rather than just devote the last 10 minutes to a good movie or something like that. How about devoting the last half an hour to some good news, to something positive, something that I love, and I will talk about that. Before that, I just wanted to note for the you Europeans out there listening, I will be in Sweden talking about the Swedish welfare state, talking about the morality of capitalism, the virtue of capitalism. I will be in Stockholm on November 12th. So November 12th, if you're in Stockholm, check out the Ayn Rand Institute website for information. But I will be there, and I will be right back after this break to talk, wrap things up about Sweden and talk maybe about Silicon Valley and some positive values, and take a call.
The Ayn Rand Institute campus is an exciting online destination offering free e-courses on Ayn Rand and her revolutionary philosophy of objectivism. Whether you recently picked up your first Rand book or have been reading her novels and nonfiction for years, ARI Campus has something for you. On campus, you'll discover a variety of multimedia courses covering Rand's literary classics, specific aspects of thought, and how to apply her ideas to your life. Get started today at campus.aynrand.org. See you on campus.
With adoring fans, rabid critics, and very few in between, why does Atlas Shrugged evoke such impassioned responses? Because it grapples with the fundamental problems of human existence and it presents radically new answers. Atlas Shrugged challenges many conventional notions about good and evil, that sex is a low animal desire, that money is the root of evil, that man is sinful by nature. One of the most prominent is the notion that selfishness is evil and self-sacrifice is good. Atlas Shrugged is a dramatization of Ayn Rand's unique vision of existence out of man's highest potential. 12 years in the writing, it is her masterwork. Rand's worldview emerges in the plot turns of this compelling mystery, centered on one question: who is John Galt? There are many legends. Which of these is true? Is he the man who discovered the Fountain of Youth? The man who found the lost city of Atlantis? A modern Prometheus? Does he even exist? And why, if no one knows the answer, does the entire world know his name? Find out the answer when you read the novel that sparked a philosophical revolution. Order it today on Amazon.com.
In 1934, Ayn Rand wrote to journalist and essayist H.L. Mencken,
Perhaps it may seem a lost cause at present, and there are those who will say that I am too late, that I can only hope to be the last fighter for a mode of thinking which has no place in the future. But I do not think so. I intend to be the first one in a new battle, which the world needs as it has never needed before. The first to answer the many too many advocates of collectivism and answer them in a manner which will not be forgotten. Every day at ARI, we work to make sure that Ayn Rand's answer will not be forgotten. Help us. Contribute today at AynRand.org/support.
Every day we hear from political leaders that the American dream is vanishing because of rising income inequality. The rich are getting richer by rigging the system, leaving the rest of us to struggle to get by. To save the American dream, we're told that we need to fight inequality through tax hikes, wealth redistribution schemes, and a far higher minimum wage. But what if that narrative is wrong? What if the real threat to the American dream is not rising inequality, but forced equality? In their forthcoming book, Equal is Unfair, America's Misguided Fight Against Income Inequality, Don Watkins and Yaron Brook reveal that almost everything we've been taught about inequality is wrong. You'll discover why successful CEOs make so much money and why they should, how the minimum wage hurts the very people it claims to help, why claims of middle-class stagnation are a myth, and more. For more information or to pre-order the book, Equal is Unfair, visit your favorite bookseller or go to Amazon.com.
Ayn Rand was a radical thinker whose philosophical novels challenged students to reconsider their views on fundamental issues. The Fountainhead, Atlas Shrugged, and Anthem. These works have become classics of American literature that never fail to engage young people and stimulate intense classroom discussion. By offering these works for free to teachers, the Ayn Rand Institute hopes to encourage greater awareness and understanding of Rand's stimulating perspective. If you're a teacher who would like Ayn Rand's books in your classroom, visit AynRand.org. This is at no cost to you. Go to AynRand.org today.
All right, we're talking about, talking about Sweden. Isn't it great to have somebody who actually has lived in a place, who actually knows what they're talking about the facts of a particular situation, a particular circumstance? So thank you, Carl, for joining us. Thanks for contributing to this discussion. The myth, the selectivity of facts that the left engages in order to raise Sweden up as an example of anything. This is the same with generally in Scandinavia, the evasion of what actually is going on and what has gone on is quite astounding. I have to give you this one concrete example, and we're going to do it quickly because I want to move on. So Bernie Sanders uses this idea that college education and grad school is free in Sweden, and isn't that a wonderful thing? But I was reading, and I didn't even know this, I was reading an article in which it said that 85% of Swedish students graduate with debt versus only 50% in the United States. Now, how can that be? Because it's free. It's free. How can they end up with debt? Well, it turns out that A, they are loaded up with all kinds of fees. But B, importantly, because of all the restrictions, because of the lack of jobs, because of the statism that exists in Sweden, the cost of living is so high that students have to take on massive amounts of debt in order to live while they're attending school. So yes, school might be free, but because school is free, guess what happens? The cost of apartments, the cost of food, the cost of transportation, the cost of everything else is really, really, really expensive. So you have to borrow money to live. Yeah, you might not have to borrow money to actually literally go to school, but of course somebody has to pay for your school, and the people who pay for your school are being taxed highly. They're not creating jobs. They're very high wages, so you don't get a job as a student. It's hard to find part-time work. So it just shows you how you can be very selective, right? And take some of the evidence. Indeed, student debt in Sweden is higher. Not just the number of students, but also the amount is higher than it is in the United States. Okay, just an anecdote to illustrate how selective they are. Okay, we've got a call. Hi, you're on the Yaron Brook Show. Who's this?
Hi, Yaron. This is Gail.
Yes. Hey, Gail, how are you?
I'm well, thanks. I heard you say you wanted to talk a little bit about Canada, I decided to call.
Good.
I'm Canadian, And I have been spending a lot of time wondering what it is about Canada that is just causing their economy to go into the tank, and which it is. And I think that, I mean, when you take that enormous country, which basically a frontier land, but it's tied up, of course, with crown lands.
Sure.
You know, it makes me think, why don't they sell off the crown lands to people and open up manufacturing? And
absolutely. I mean what's happened? What's happened in Canada is that you know, the land is owned by, what it means by crown land is it means it's owned by the state. It means it's owned by by the statists, and so it's very limited. The ability to be entrepreneurial on that land is very limited. And Canada was doing very well when natural resource prices were going up and up and up and up. But once the price of commodities, oil and other commodities, plummeted, and there's very, as you said, there's little manufacturing, there's little of these other entrepreneurial activities.
Yes, it's such a thin veneer that supports the economy and the trickle down from that.
Yeah, and the solution, the solution last week was, let's vote in a real socialist.
Oh, yeah.
Right? That's what you Canadians
Well, now they're really in trouble. And, I mean, if he's anything like his dad, who is Pierre Elliott Trudeau, who nationalized the energy industry in Canada, I was there when that happened. And, you know, it was disastrous. And they sort of removed that, but underneath it all, it's still really quite nationalized, you know, in a different way.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think it's more like fascism than actual outright public utility, you know.
Yes, but, which is what so much of the Western world is moving towards, is more of a fascist type economy where we regulate business to death rather than taking it over and nationalizing it.
Right, and I mean, everything that Canadians enjoy is coming across the border from America. And, you know,
you're probably
I mean,
the only Canadian in the world who says that, right?
I know I am. And
Canadians hate Americans.
That's right. Well, I'm not one. In fact, I live down here half the time, and I love it here, and I wish I could stay here. But the thing is, you know, what the heck is made in Canada? I mean, if Canadians would only look around them and see...
Very little entrepreneurship, and
very little creativity and all that. Everything is a secondhand of something else, including their culture and their music and everything else. You know, there's no originality. In fact, I think about Canada, I think about, and people won't like me saying this, but if you've read the book, The Fountainhead, Canada's like Peter Keating
and
America's
absolutely.
You know, is Howard. Yeah. So that's my 2 cents worth.
Great. Thanks, Gail. Really appreciate it. Really appreciate it. I'm going to talk a little bit about Canada now because Gail brought it up. So I agree with Gail completely. And the issue with Canada is that Canada is European. And Canada has very much the philosophy, the egalitarianism, the altruism, the collectivism of Europe. It's toned down a little bit, particularly in Western Canada, but generally Canada, I think, prides itself to a large extent of being, in some senses, culturally, more similar to Europe than it is to the United States. So as a consequence, Canada did the same thing, very similar to Sweden. It became quite socialist in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, and drove itself quite bankrupt, just like Sweden, until the 1990s, where they became a lot more and not for ideological reasons, but for practical reasons. They were basically, Canada was going bankrupt. They started shrinking government expenditure. They started shrinking the government. And by the way, this was under the same Liberal government, the same Liberal Party that has now been elected. The difference is that back then they were practical Liberals. They were reformers. They actually freed up their economy. They were much more like a Tony Blair leftist. And Canada's done fairly well under that and with a conservative prime minister under until recently. And again, not dramatically good, nothing phenomenal. A lot of it has to do with just natural resources and the prices of commodities, but done fairly well. And then once those commodity prices plummeted and Canadian economy slowed down dramatically, they have gone back to the radical left. They've gone back to that egalitarianism, that altruism, that collectivism, and voted in a socialist last week. And indeed, the trend right now in the West, which is very scary, is to go back to a much more ideological left. If you see, and we've talked about this on this show, the election of Corbyn in England as head of the Labour Union, Labour Party, who is an out-and-out socialist, the popularity of Bernie Sanders in the United States, and the election of Trudeau in Canada all suggest to me that there's definitely, in the Anglo-Saxon world at least, a trend to towards a more radical left, a socialist, nihilist left. So worse than socialism, a combination of socialism and nihilism. And we should all be scared of that. And I think because not maybe somebody like Bernie Sanders can't win, but he is going to drag and pull Hillary Clinton, who is likely to win the next election and be the next president of the United States. It's going to really move Hillary Clinton further to the left and move the entire Democratic Party further to the left. It's going to do the same thing in British politics. No matter who ultimately rises to the top in the Labour Party, they're going to be more leftist than otherwise, because they're going to have to find a way to appease this progressive nihilistic left. So I really, really, really worry about the political trends, because if the left moves dramatically to the left, the right will move further to the left as well. That's been the history of politics in Anglo-Saxon countries. When the right moves a little bit to the right, like with Thatcher and with Ronald Reagan, the left moves a little bit to the right, like Bill Clinton and Tony Blair. But the right is not what's dominant right now intellectually. It's the left, and the left is going to push us to the, you know, further and further to the left. Okay, I want to shift now and talk about something positive. I really wanted to spend a little bit more time not being dour, as somebody on the chat earlier mentioned. We are always so dour. I want to talk about Silicon Valley, and I don't have much time. We'll have to devote a whole show to this, but I really want to talk about, you know, the entrepreneurship, the energy that Silicon Valley projects. And Silicon Valley is really an embodiment of so many of the objectivist virtues, of the virtues articulated by Ayn Rand in her novels. You know, it's a place of unbelievable productiveness. I mean, so much of the economic successes in America today emanate from Silicon Valley. There's almost nothing that is really dramatically positive that is not coming from technology, from the technology sector. If you go to Silicon Valley, if you spend some time there, what you'll see is it's just the energy, the excitement, the thrill of work, of production, of building something, of dreaming, of creating, of making. I read a quote here something about Silicon Valley culture, and it's about anybody not willing to live within the dream machine leaves, is kicked out in a sense. The Valley likes new ideas and the people crazy enough to pursue them. If you're not willing to dream big, you may need to move on. Now what a culture, right? It's not a culture that kicks people out literally, or that build walls not to allow them to come in. It's a culture that basically says, this is what we stand for. We stand for hard work and dreaming big and new ideas and entrepreneurship. And if you don't abide by these values, if you don't want to join in these values, you have no place here. You're going to fail. You're going to be miserable here. So you might as well either not come or leave if you're already here. And it's a culture that celebrates independence. It's a culture that celebrates independence because it celebrates new ideas. It celebrates entrepreneurship. It celebrates the dreamers. And 90% of the time, one of these companies is founded most of the people are saying, eh, that's not going to be successful. That's not going to go anywhere. I mean, most companies, even the most successful companies in Silicon Valley, get rejected by venture capitalists over and over and over again until they find somebody to believe in them. So think of the independence you have to have in order to endure and know, and this is nuts, and that's a stupid idea, and that's a ridiculous idea, and keep going. And this is true of eBay. Who would have found it? Who would have given millions of dollars to eBay? I mean, I was there in the Valley, lived in the Valley when eBay was founded, and the idea of having a classified section where people bid on stuff online seemed absurd and ridiculous to me. I wouldn't have given them a dime. And they were turned down by multiple VCs. And, of course, the VC that ultimately funded them, one of the biggest success stories ever in terms of wealth creation. An incredible amount of independence. The Howard Roarks, the Reardons, that's where they live. They live in Silicon Valley. And I'm not just talking about Silicon Valley in California, but the Silicon Valley is all around the United States of America, the islands of entrepreneurship, the islands of innovation, the islands of technology that exists out there. So it's about productiveness, it's about independence, and it's about justice. You're productive, you work hard, you do well. If you don't, you're out. And it doesn't matter where you got your degree from. I have a very good friend who has a degree. It's not even a bachelor's degree. I forget the name of it, but it's a 2 or 3 year degree rather than a 4 year degree from a college in Israel. And you know, went to work at some startups, got the opportunities, did well, but never really hit it big at a startup. Went to work at one of the major companies, and is doing fantastically well. Even though he came to Silicon Valley relative to Silicon Valley later in life. But I know people who go to Silicon Valley at 18 without any college degree and do fantastically well. It's a just environment. People get treated the way they deserve. People get rewarded the way they deserve. You can become a gazillionaire. You can become a billionaire at a very young age because you produced, you created, you've made something. An associate's degree, that's the kind of degree I was talking about. It's an incredible place of justice. And if you're lazy, if you're not good, if you're just not good, you're not going to be successful. So it exemplifies productiveness, independence, justice, and ultimately it exemplifies reason. Because the role of the mind in human life is so made obvious by what is created in Silicon Valley. It's not about, because in Silicon Valley, they don't make anything in a sense, right? iPhones are not built in Silicon Valley. But the idea of an iPhone is made possible in Silicon Valley. And what Silicon Valley is all about is ideas. It's about the use of the mind. There's no muscle. It's all mind. How can you be a Marxist after the existence of Silicon Valley? I mean, how can you be a Marxist in the Industrial Revolution? But how could Marx be a Marxist? But Silicon Valley blows Marxism out of the water. Look at the value creation. Look at the role of man-mind. Wow, it's just unbelievable. And this still exists in 21st century America. With all the statism and the regulations and controls, they have carved out an island of relative freedom. Now the freedom is shrinking. There's more and more regulation, and yet they keep fighting on. They're the Dagnys and the Reardons of our modern world. They are the Atlases holding up this world. And I'll give you a couple of negatives. Or supposed negatives. They all vote Democratic. I mean, Silicon Valley is overwhelmingly politically Democrat. And yet, they're the heroes. Life is not about politics. It's not about who you vote for. That's not the essential. We should celebrate their productiveness, their use of reason, their independence, the sense of justice that permeates Silicon Valley. I lived there for 7 years, and wow, what a great place to live. At 2 a.m, you could travel around certain areas in Silicon Valley. All the lights are on because people are working, because people engage in productive activity. The energy was palpable. and the energy is palpable again today. So, what an exciting place. And yet they vote Democratic, and it's sad that they vote Democratic, but I think that should be an indication that there's something wrong with a message that the right is conveying. Maybe people so dedicated to reason, productiveness, independence, and justice don't want to hear about how God speaks to you. And that, you know, you get messages from God through reading the Bible or whatever. Maybe people who are actually productive, who actually use reason, don't want religion in their politics. Maybe the reason they vote Democratic is because Republicans tend to be so anti-science and anti-reason. I blame it on the Republicans. I don't blame it on the people in Silicon Valley. And indeed, as objectivists, if we're going to win over the world, then it's Silicon Valley we need to win over. If we're going to win over the culture, it's the culture of Silicon Valley that needs to be won over. By the way, just as a quick connection to last week's show, about 50% of all Silicon Valley startups are started by immigrants. A huge percentage of that culture, of that vibrancy, of that productiveness, of that independence, of that sense of justice in Silicon Valley comes from its immigrants. So how you can be anti-immigration when you can see the enormous, incredible, unbelievable value? And again, maybe this is why they vote Democratic, because Republicans spew out anti-immigration all the time, not just illegal immigration, but they don't advocate for legal and massive expansion of legal immigration, which is what they should stand for and what they should be all about. So I'm a huge fan of Silicon Valley. One of these days we'll do a whole show, whether it's Uber, whether it's Apple, whether it's Amazon. And I know Amazon's in Seattle and Microsoft's in Seattle, but I consider them all part of Silicon Valley. And the companies in Austin, the companies in Boston, they're all part of this culture, which is a culture of technology. And it is the brightest thing going on in America today, the most important thing going on in today. Now, I want to end with a movie recommendation, and one that I said I would talk about. And it's great because this is a great lead-in, because this is a movie that I really enjoyed. It's called The Martian, which I recommend everybody go. But it's a movie that celebrates human reason. It celebrates man's capacity to use his reason for his survival and to survive in the most unwelcoming environment possible, to change that environment to fit his needs so that he survives. So it's a wonderful concretization of the efficacy of the human mind and the efficacy of reason, of the ability of man to survive. It's a man versus nature story done well. There are a number of movies that have been created over the years that have this theme, and some of the show, I'll list a few of them. There are quite a few that are good. This one's good. It's not great. I'd say it's not great because it lacks a certain sense of drama. It lacks a certain intensity. It lacks a certain sense of suspense. You kind of get a sense of exactly what's going to happen very early on. I mean, the details are different, and details are interesting, and I enjoyed the details, and I enjoyed the movie. It certainly lacks a certain drama. And the thing it really doesn't dramatize or fails to dramatize is the issue of free will. It's the choices made. Reason is efficacious, is there. But the need to exercise that reason, to turn it on, to will it, if you will, to will it, is really not well dramatized. There's a little bit of it there, but it's not dramatized. And that is unfortunately, you know, it's unfortunately lacking. But given that, I would still recommend the movie. It's still very enjoyable. At least I enjoyed it. It's still true that you know, you really see what knowledge, education, and thinking can achieve. And while they don't dramatize the choices that the hero makes, and they don't even dramatize, I don't think, very well the choices other people make, even though they're clear choices, they're not very – it just has a certain dramatic flatness to it, unfortunately. But it's still wonderful in the world we live in today with the politics and the other movies made, which are all about emotion and about stupidity and about celebrating the stupid, particularly our comedies, a real celebration of mediocrity and stupidity and so on. To watch a movie about something positive, but not just anything positive, something positive in the sense of the mind, in a sense of reason. How rare is that? How unusual is that? So I really enjoyed it, and really enjoyed it, particularly in the context, again, of what is typically available out there and what typically you can see in the movies. You know, I wish they'd make more movies like this. And now, I mentioned that this is a man versus nature movie, and it's important to note that man versus nature movie have limitations dramatically. They're just not as good as man versus evil man, right? As real drama between different people engaged in a struggle that has much more potential for drama, much more potential for being great, for being engaging, and for dramatizing real values. And of course, Ayn Rand argued that the most powerful drama of all is the drama of man versus a great men who are mistaken. You know, think about We the Living. Think about the characters in Atlas Shrugged, where the real drama is, in a sense, between John Galt and Dagny Taggart. So, Dagny represents the mistake, right? Think about The Fountainhead, with the drama of Howard Roark versus Dominique, who is mistaken. She's not bad. So the dramatic elements vary, and there's only so much you can do when it's, in a sense, just a survival movie. There's only so much drama you can create around a story where nature, in a sense, is passive, and where the hero is engaged against this passive force. The movie I'm talking about is The Martian. It's at the theaters right now. I think the acting is excellent. I think it's well shot. It's Ridley Scott, who has a very, very mixed history in terms of making films. Some of his early films were brilliant. Some of his later films are being duds. And some of the middle films have been kind of neither here nor there, kind of mixtures. But overall, good movie. Go see it. Enjoy. Now, I'll be back next week with the Iran Book Show. Following, though, next week, I will be traveling. I'll be traveling for Europe. I will be in Europe for 2 weeks, 8 different countries, giving anywhere between 13 or 14 talks all over Europe, but primarily Eastern and Northern Europe. As I said, I'll be in Sweden November 12th. And while I'm gone, we will have guest hosts filling in for me. So starting with the show following next one, we will have guest hosts for all of the middle of November. I hope you'll enjoy that. A little bit of variety, a little bit of a different voice online. But thank you for listening. For listening to the show. Hope you promote it. I think there's a lot of cool information about Sweden that a lot of people out there in the culture needs. So help us get the word out. Help us follow us on the show. Follow me on Twitter. Like me on Facebook. And I will see you all next Saturday, 11:30 a.m. Pacific Time,
on Blog Talk Radio. This is Yaron Brook on the Yaron Brook Show.